Well, good morning, everybody. Thank you for making it to church. Holy moly, if you survived Big Spring or just all the routes, they're playing games with us. So I took Lamisa, and you know there's road construction over there too. It's like, this is not fun. So you're here. You've accomplished all you've needed to do today. We are not even halfway through, but a good way through a Revelation, which is, on the one hand, one of the more intriguing books of the Bible. On the other hand, it's one of the more challenging, convoluted. It is a book that is very much not part of our culture, not part of our understanding. You know, as Christians, we're kind of children of a mixed marriage, if you will, in terms of culture. On the one hand, our thinking, our government, our philosophy is very much a child of the Greeks and the Romans. We have philosophy, we have democracy, all that kind of stuff. But our religion is very much a product of Jewish thinking, which is ancient Near Eastern thinking. So it's very different kind of thinking processes that come together. But for the most part, we think Greek. So the parts of the Bible that are more Greek are easier for us to read. So parts of the Gospels, particularly John, are easier for us. And Paul's writings are easier for us. Those, in particular Romans, stuff like that, are the most Greek. So they make sense to us. Where things like Revelation, Daniel, Ezekiel are the most Jewish. And the most, I'm going to use the term apocalyptic. They are the most ancient Near Eastern. Now, by way of quick review, when we talk about apocalyptic, in English, we almost always then think of the end of the world. When this was first developed biblically and in the ancient Near East, apocalyptic literature did not mean end of the world. It could include that, but what it really meant was the hidden meaning, the greater truth, if you will. Biblically, this stemmed from the fact that Israel lost its country. They went into exile. After all the miracles that they were delivered from Egypt, they came into the promised land. They then lost it, sort of in two stages. Assyria destroyed the north, and then Babylon destroyed the south, Judah. And so they go into slavery, in essence, again in Babylon. And so the latter half of the Old Testament is asking the big question, why? How did this happen? Did God give up on us? Is God evil? Is the problem with us? Is the problem with our kings? What happened? And so the way that they begin to answer this question is looking for this greater truth. What is it? What happened? Why did God leave us? And the answer is because they sinned. They were not the people that they needed to be. But the way that it tends to be expressed is in this apocalyptic manner. So the big challenge is that we tend to deal in abstractions. So we can say quite easily, God is all-knowing. We can formulate in our brain this idea that there is a capacity of all things that are known. In a Babylonian concept or a Jewish concept, that seems kind of silly. So what they would do instead is they would imagine something in this world that captures all knowledge. And they would say, it's like this. So where Greeks will imagine something, a Jewish idea is going to say, it's like something. For example, we've seen this before, it's just by way of review. Greek will say, God is all-seeing, omniscient. He sees everything. Omni, literally Greek, all-seeing. A Jewish view, an apocalyptic view, would say, an angel, because they're not going to describe God, that you can't completely describe God, and you wouldn't want to because he's beyond description. But an angel that stands next to God is covered in eyes. Why? Because an eye is what sees. And an eye that's all over the body of an angel is going to see everything. So the eyes aren't so much really describing the angel. What they're doing is telling you about God. So they're saying the same thing in very different ways. Does that make sense? So all seeing versus covered in eyes. Now John, who was an apostle, a disciple of Jesus, became an apostle. He's the last living disciple. Remember, he's been arrested by the Romans. They've treated him terribly. They sent him to a mining colony on the island of Patmos. He was intended to die. He doesn't. He goes back to Ephesus, where he's treated like a living saint. And he writes in Ephesus his vision of this greater truth. Now remember, there's a Roman emperor at the time named Domitian, and he is a nut job, right? This is the guy. He is the second son of this military emperor that's come to power. We won't get into all that, but Rome is sort of going through emperors in quick succession. And what does Emperor Domitian decide he needs to be called? Remember?
Lord and God.
Lord and God. Right. It just rolls off the tongue, right? And so he often has himself depicted with this scroll, right? It is all of his titles. It is a scroll with all of his titles that controls seven seals. And so much of what is happening in John is sort of this anti-Domitian idea. Domitian is making sure that everybody dedicates themselves to him, sort of acknowledging his seven scrolls or his seven sealed scrolls. Jesus is presented as a counter to that. As Domitian begins to force people to worship him, Jesus is presented as the opposite of that. So we're shown this image in heaven where there's only one being, one person that's capable of opening the scroll. And it's not Domitian, it's not the emperor, it's Jesus. So I know we have some new folks, and you guys are getting in the deep end of the pool today. Sorry. We're in like chapter 6. It's been deep. But let me try a quick review and to throw you in the deep end. Hopefully this will make sense. Get your floaties out, because it's going to be a challenge. But so we had this crash course on the difference between abstract thinking and apocalyptic thinking. So, if I say to you, in a Greek way, the gospel of Jesus Christ is the most powerful message that has ever been presented. Okay, that's a Greek rendering. The gospel message of Jesus Christ is the most powerful message ever given. How would I say that in apocalyptic terms?
Powerful
animal? Yes. What kind of animal?
A horse.
Hmm?
A horse.
A horse? Nope. Horses are kind of late to...
Lion, bear,
yeah? So what have they chosen to depict Jesus?
A lamb.
Yes. Why?
Sacrifice.
Yeah. What kind of sacrifice?
Blood sacrifice. A pure holy sacrifice.
Yeah. It's the Passover lamb. So that, remember, it's not the cross that we consistently see as the image of Jesus. It's the lamb. So remember in Passover, in Exodus, when the angel of death comes to claim the firstborn, there's this pure, innocent lamb that's sacrificed. Its throat is slit. The blood is taken out. And the blood of the lamb is put on the doorpost of each home. And when the angel of death comes, if it sees the blood of the lamb on the door, it turns away. And so when Jesus Jesus dies, he is this lamb. His blood, his soul, where blood is the sign for a soul, this blood of the lamb is what saves the world. So every time in Revelation we're talking about Jesus, it's a lamb, okay? So, yes, they pick a lamb. So we'd have a lamb. What shows authority in apocalyptic literature? And the reason we go through this is because there is a range of meaning, okay? A lot of people get into this apocalyptic literature stuff and they go nuts, right? They're like, okay, Oprah Winfrey is the Antichrist because, no, it doesn't mean that stuff. You know, if I hurry up today, we'll get into some of the numerology, which I tend to avoid because people go nuts with this stuff. Unless you're raised with it, you really should avoid it. But there is a range of meaning, and that's what we want to set. So, we got the lamb. That's easy. How do they tend to show authority, power?
Lion.
Lion, yeah. But who's in charge? Who's powerful?
Caesar,
yeah. But in the animal world, who's the boss? How do you show a crown in the animal world?
Horns,
exactly. Remember, well, we haven't got there yet, but one of the ways that we'll see that the serpent is Satan is bad is because of the horns that he has. It's so, like, if you go to get a big buck, right? How many points do you want? As many as possible. And so they'll do the same kind of thing. You will count the points on the head. And numbers are the ways that Hebrews will show punctuation marks. Certain numbers, 3, 7, 10, 12, variations of that are important. And really that's what you need to know. 3, 7, and variations of that. So 10 and 12 are variations of 3 and 7. So 3 is the divine number, 7 is complete. So 3 and 7 together are 10, and then the variation is 12. So if that's all the numerology you ever learn, and then 24 is 2 12s. So that's probably all you ever need to know.
Wait, how do you get 12 from 7 and 3?
Great question.
How are you getting
12? 4, 3, 7,
and 3.
4, 3. Yeah, I'm forgetting 4.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is going to come up in just a second. Because there's four corners, which is how they view the world. So complete.
Yeah.
And the thing I'm leaving off is wings. Wings means it's fast. We saw this in Ezekiel. When you talk about angels, invariably they will have wings, sometimes two, sometimes three, and it shows that they're swift and they're coming. So what kind of picture do we have now? We have a lamb. What does it have? It has horns. How many horns would you guess?
Four.
Yeah. Well.
You saying the lamb has horns? Is that what you said? The lamb.
Has yeah. I mean, it's not a naturally occurring thing, right? There, most of these animals that they will describe. Yeah. It's hard to think this way, right? Because it's strange. Yeah. Okay. So let me show you.
How many horns does the lamb have?
This is the gospel is the most powerful thing ever written. So it's the lamb. How many heads does it have? So I'm actually cheating here. This is a little later rendition, but the reason they're doing four is because of the four Gospels. It's got 10 horns, so it's this complete power. And then it's got the wings because it's fast. So I know it's being thrown into the deep end, but it's not some weird we were smoking dope, or maybe something ever. And I have to confess, I was telling everybody, I'm off the hydrocodone today for my back, so it makes sense, and you should just go with it. No.
How many horns did it have left?
Yeah. I don't know. They kept moving. So this is the challenge of Revelation, being able to sort of step outside, understand it biblically, the match. Remember, Daniel in particular, but a certain degree, Ezekiel always sort of has the primer for this. It's not like we're just making this up whole cloth. They showed us how they were doing this in Babylon, and then John has been raised in this. Sort of when you poke John, you get the Galilean Jew that comes out of him. And so when God sort of gave this revelation to him, this is really speaking his language. So if we really want to get the depth of what Jesus revealed to him, we sort of have to go down this road. The most important thing, too, about this apocalyptic literature is it's designed to show what's happened in the past, what's happening now, and what will happen in the future. So you got to get all three parts of it. A lot of times when we read Revelation, we're just thinking it's in the future. There is certainly a future element to it. But in order to get what's going to happen, you have to see what has happened, what is happening, and what will happen in the future. And so we got to pick all of those parts out. So without further introduction, let's jump into chapter 6, I believe. We're breaking seals, right? So chapter 6, verse 9. So we have this great scroll. The scroll is ultimately answering the question, what is the purpose of humanity? What is God going to do with the evil that comes out of us? What is God going to do with the evil that Rome is doing to the believers in Christ? What is God going to do with us? How is he going to resolve this? So we pick up in verse 9. When the Lamb broke the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of all who had been martyred for the word of God and for being faithful in their testimony. They shouted to the Lord and said, O sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long before you judge the people who belong to this world and avenge our blood for what they have done to us? Holy moly! Okay, so remember we've been following this sort of divine image where John is seeing God on the throne. He can't completely see and depict God, but you remember what is the color of God? I mean, it's this incredible light, but what is the color?
White.
Hmm?
White.
No.
It's like garnet.
Yeah. It's a reddish color, reflecting the high priest's jewels. So remember, it's this reddish amber almost color, and it's surrounded by a green halo. And then he has these, we'll call them cherubim. The Greek is zoion, living beings, sphinx-like creatures that are surrounding him. And then he has 24 elders around him. And then the Lamb has been there. So now we have this altar. And the altar is connected to these martyrs. We've talked about them before. First martyr was in reference to those that were giving their testimony to Jesus. testimony to others about the message, and then it turned into those that were killed for sharing their message to Jesus, and they were killed by the Romans. We'll talk about this a great deal more, but you were required in order to do business in the Agora. It's sort of like the business center of towns like Ephesus and Corinth and the big Roman cities were Domitian, especially in Ephesus. In order to do business, you had to sort of go to the center altar. You had to offer incense to Domitian that he was Lord and God. You just offer a little incense to Domitian, make all these claims. The Christians couldn't do it, or they could do it and just lie. If you didn't do it, you couldn't do business. And so that was the first strike against you. You would suffer. And then when they discover you're not doing it, they're going to try to force you to do it. And then when you don't do it, you get in trouble. And then if you really don't do it, then it gets ugly. And eventually they're killing people, putting them in the arena for not doing this. And so it's gone on. Now, it's a reflection of what's happened in the past. When the Babylonians had done this for not worshiping the statue of Nebuchadnezzar. It's happening under the Romans. It's going to happen in the future when the Antichrist and the new Babylon and all that kind of stuff demand that we worship the beast, and we won't do it. We sometimes forget in God's grace that God is also a just God, and that dictators and monsters seem to get away with stuff. This is a reminder that God keeps account, that he will not forget the people that are killed being righteous. I mean, we're in a different place as Christians today in the world than we were when I was a kid. I mean, that whole mess at the Olympics, that seemed like to be the big give us a finger as Christians. And so that was a shock. But compared to what they're going through, let's say, in North Korea, in Pakistan, China, we do still have it really good as Christians. I hope the United States always stays as a Christian nation. But God watches, and he will avenge. Look at
avenging blood, you were excited souls, avenging
that were lost. Yeah, for sure. And so God will make it right. So we got to pick apart this a little bit. Verse 10, so the souls shout out and said, "O sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long before you judge the people who belong to this world and avenge our blood for what they have done to us?" Does God avenge?
Would you consider Sodom and Gomorrah avenging?
Yeah. I think one of the worst things we do as Christians is try to explain away what the Bible says. You know, it's sometimes we treat the Bible like it's our elderly grandparent, and they're saying something they're not supposed to, right? It's like, no, you don't mean that. You don't mean that, Grandpa, shut up. Actually, it really should work the other way, right? We should like, oh, okay, the Bible says that. God is gracious, absolutely. And God is loving, absolutely. But God is also just, and he holds people to account. Now, one of the things we have to really appreciate about this is in apocalyptic literature, there's there's like sections that God goes through, and it gives you kind of a false sense that God is like, okay, there's first period and second period and third period, and it's not quite working that way. But what they're insinuating is that God gives people a choice. So he's letting you do this, and when everybody's made their choice, then he'll do this. And that's really what this is implying, that, you know, God is giving the martyrs their choice to be faithful, and he's giving the perpetrators a chance to make their choice. And once they've chosen, then he'll act. If you choose to do evil, then he's going to try to remedy that situation. Remember, you know, Paul, even when he had been involved in murder, God would still give him a chance, still try to intervene to change it. God will give you to the last second to change. But if you're going to murder and that's your choice, he's going to find a way to take care of those that have been killed. For a Hebrew, and remember, this is where John's coming from. Your tribe, your family, your clan is everything. And so the one that avenges you is the one you really can depend on. So if I ask you today, if someone's beating you up, if someone's hurting you, who is going to come stop that? I mean, not call 911, but who's going to come help you? Get in it. I mean, throw up fists and if you're stuck in Houston and you can't drive, who's going to throw you in the back of a Suburban and get you home? Who is that? And that's who the Hebrews understand God to be, that he is their blood kin. You know, God forbid if somebody kidnaps you, who's going to pay the ransom? They believe that's who God is. And so they're sort of playing to that idea. Now, what's going to happen in a minute that's going to blow their mind is that God, Jesus, is saying, I do that for you, but I'm also going to do it for everybody. So it's a huge step. But to be so avenger and redeemer, blood redeemer, is the same kind of concept in Hebrew. So the people are crying out, you know, we have paid the ultimate price, and God said, I hear that, and I'm gonna make it right. How you can separate who's guilty and who's not and who deserves a chance and all that, it's a mess. You know, I listen to the stories my wife tells with the court system trying to figure out sex crimes and murders, and it's a mess. And our system is imperfect. But I think the one person that really can do it is God. And that's why he is worthy to open up the seal. So verse 11, then a white robe was given to each of them. So remember way before the break, what does the white robe represent? Priests. Way back, that was God's desire for us. Well, good morning, everybody. Thank you for making it to church. Holy moly, if you survived Big Spring or just all the routes, they're playing games with us. So I took La Mesa, and you know there's road construction over there too. It's like this is not fun. So you're here. You've accomplished all you've needed to do today. We are not even halfway through, but a good way through a Revelation, which is, on the one hand, one of the more intriguing books of the Bible. On the other hand, it's one of the more challenging, convoluted. It is a book that is very much not part of our culture, not part of our understanding. You know, as Christians, we're kind of children of a mixed marriage, if you will, in terms of culture. On the one hand, our thinking, our government, our philosophy is very much a child of the Greeks and the Romans. We have philosophy, we have democracy, all that kind of stuff. But our religion is very much a product of Jewish thinking, which is ancient Near Eastern thinking. So it's very different kind of thinking processes that come together. But for the most part, we think Greek. So the parts of the Bible that are more Greek are easier for us to read. So parts of the Gospels, particularly John, are easier for us, and Paul's writings are easier for us. Those, in particular Romans, stuff like that, are the most Greek, so they make sense to us. Where things like Revelation, Daniel, Ezekiel are the most Jewish, and the most, I'm going to use the term apocalyptic. They are the most ancient Near Eastern. Now, by way of quick review, when we talk about apocalyptic, in English, we almost always then think of the end of the world. When this was first developed biblically and in the ancient Near East, apocalyptic literature did not mean end of the world. It could include that, but what it really meant was the hidden meaning, the greater truth, if you will. Biblically, this stemmed from the fact that Israel lost its country. They went into exile. After all the miracles that they were delivered from Egypt, they came into the promised land. They then lost it, sort of in two stages. Assyria destroyed the north, and then Babylon destroyed the south, Judah. And so they go into slavery, in essence, again in Babylon. And so the latter half of the Old Testament is asking the big question, why? How did this happen? Did God give up on us? Is God evil? Is the problem with us? Is the problem with our kings? What happened? And so the way that they begin to answer this question is looking for this greater truth. What is it? What happened? Why did God leave us? And the answer is because they sinned. They were not the people that they needed to be. But the way that it tends to be expressed is in this apocalyptic manner. So the big challenge is that we tend to deal in abstractions. So we can say quite easily, God is all-knowing. We can formulate in our brain this idea that there is a capacity of all things that are known. In a Babylonian concept or a Jewish concept, that seems kind of silly. So what they would do instead is they would imagine something in this world that captures all knowledge. And they would say, it's like this. So where Greeks will imagine something, a Jewish idea is going to say, it's like something. For example, we've seen this before, it's just by way of review. Greek will say God is all-seeing, omniscient. He sees everything. Omni, literally Greek, all-seeing. A Jewish view, an apocalyptic view, would say an angel, because they're not going to describe God, that you can't completely describe God, and you wouldn't want to because he's beyond description. But an angel that stands next to God is covered in eyes. Why? Because an eye is what sees. And an eye that's all over the body of an angel is going to see everything. So the eyes aren't so much really describing the angel. What they're doing is telling you about God. So they're saying the same thing in very different ways. Does that make sense? So all seeing versus covered in eyes. Now John, who was an apostle, a disciple of Jesus, became an apostle. He's the last living disciple. Remember, he's been arrested by the Romans. They treated him terribly. They sent him to a mining colony on the island of Patmos. He was intended to die. He doesn't. He goes back to Ephesus, where he's treated like a living saint. And he writes in Ephesus his vision of this greater truth. Now remember, there's a Roman emperor at the time named Domitian, and he is a nut job, right? This is the guy. He is the second son of this military emperor that's come to power. We won't get into all that, but Rome is sort of going through emperors in quick succession. And what does Emperor Domitian decide he needs to be called? Remember?
Lord and God.
Lord and God. Right. It just rolls off the tongue, right? And so he often has himself depicted with this scroll, right? It is all of his titles. It is a scroll with all of his titles that controls seven seals. And so much of what is happening in John is sort of this anti-Domitian idea. Domitian is making sure that everybody dedicates themselves to him, sort of acknowledging his seven scrolls or his seven sealed scrolls. Jesus is presented as a counter to that. As Domitian begins to force people to worship him, Jesus is presented as the opposite of that. So we're shown this image in heaven where there's only one being, one person that's capable of opening the scroll. And it's not Domitian, it's not the emperor, it's Jesus. So I know we have some new folks, and you guys are getting in the deep end of the pool today. Sorry, we're in like chapter 6. It's been deep, but let me try a quick review and to throw you in the deep end. Hopefully this will make sense. Get your floaties out because it's going to be a challenge. But so we had this crash course on the difference between abstract thinking and apocalyptic thinking. So, if I say to you, in a Greek way, the gospel of Jesus Christ is the most powerful message that has ever been presented. Okay, that's a Greek rendering. The gospel message of Jesus Christ is the most powerful message ever given. How would I say that in apocalyptic terms? Yes. What kind of animal?
A horse.
A horse? Nope. Horses are kind of late to.
Lion, bear, probably.
Yeah. So what have they chosen to depict Jesus?
A lamb.
Yes. Why?
Sacrifice.
Yeah. What kind of sacrifice?
Blood sacrifice. A pure, holy sacrifice.
Yeah. It's the Passover lamb. So that, remember, it's not the cross that we consistently see as the image of Jesus. It's the lamb. So remember in Passover, in Exodus, when the angel of death comes to claim the firstborn, there's this pure, innocent lamb that's sacrificed. Its throat is slit. The blood is taken out. And the blood of the lamb is put on the doorpost of each home. And when the angel of death comes, if it sees the blood of the lamb on the door, it turns away. And so when Jesus dies, he is this lamb. His blood, his soul, where blood is the sign for a soul, this blood of the lamb is what saves the world. So every time in Revelation we're talking about Jesus, it's a lamb, okay? So, yes, they pick a lamb. So we'd have a lamb. What shows authority in apocalyptic literature? And the reason we go through this is because there is a range of meaning, okay? A lot of people get into this apocalyptic literature stuff and they go nuts, right? They're like, okay, Oprah Winfrey is the Antichrist because, no, it doesn't mean that stuff. You know, if I hurry up today, we'll get into some of the numerology, which I tend to avoid because people go nuts with this stuff. Unless you're raised with it, you really should avoid it. There is a range of meaning, and that's what we want to set. So, we got the lamb. That's easy. How do they tend to show authority, power?
Lion.
Lion, yeah. But who's in charge? Who's powerful?
Caesar,
yeah. But in the animal world, who's the boss? How do you show a crown in the animal?